This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 302 was recorded on December 16th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Fasanara Capital founder Francesco Filiat returns as this week's feature interview guest. Francesco surprised me with a chart deck quite different than those he's shared with us in the past. He'll share a vision for the coming digitization of financial assets, which differs considerably from my own. That's coming up in this week's feature interview. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when I'll be giving an update on how the Omicron variant has reshaped my own market outlook, and then Patrick's chart deck, which is titled Santa Claus Rally or Lump of Coal.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to the S&P 500. We saw a little bit of weakness at the start of the week, but as we went into that FOMC, a pretty decisive reversal up to retest its previous highs. Is the bull trend going to continue into a Santa Claus rally in your mind?
I think it probably will, at least in the immediate short-term sense. So maybe through Christmas. That's pretty short-term at this point. The thing is, I think that there could be a bearish surprise coming in a major spike in cases as a result of Omicron. And we can save that for the post-game segment, Patrick. I want to give a full update on that subject.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, which was running a pretty clean bull trend, but seems to have come off of its highs, at least modestly in that off that FOMC meeting. Your view on the dollar change in any way?
No, it really hasn't. We're consolidating between 95.5 and 97 on the dollar index after a fairly big move up. Nothing more to say, really, until there's a daily close outside that range.
All right, Eric, let's get to crude oil. We obviously had a liquidity event that happened in late November, which saw that enormous drop back down towards the summer lows in the low 60s. But we've had a pretty decisive bounce off that low. And even today, we're slowly edging toward that $73 high we saw last week. Do you think crude oil is just going to keep ripping higher from here?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily going to keep ripping higher. It's a very complex market, Patrick. What I do think, Patrick, is that crude oil by next summer will be worth probably about twice what it is now. That's optimistic, perhaps, but I think there's more likely to be in that range than in the current range. The thing is that there could be a really big spike in Omicron case count, and that could spook the market lower, at least in the short term, and that causes me to really put the brakes on backing the leverage truck up, because I think we could have still a lower low before this is over. In any event, let's save the Omicron analysis for the post-game segment. EIA inventory coming in this week with crude oil drawing down a massive 4.6 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma building 1.3 million barrels, desperately needed there in order to replenish stocks in Cushing, but still big drawdowns on gasoline, 719,000 barrels, and then 2.9 million barrels drawn down on distillates, with U.S. production holding unchanged at 11.7 million barrels. Obviously, a fairly bullish inventory report that caused the market to react positively, but not super positively. We didn't really get the retest of the 100-day moving average up at $73 until this morning. That was not in reaction to inventory news. That didn't happen until Thursday morning. We've now tested that 100-day moving average, Patrick, about 5 times now in this cycle. And it may be that we're getting ready to break above it. I certainly think that where we're headed is much, much higher on oil prices. The thing is, there's about to be an explosion in case counts. And it seems right now like the narrative is tuned toward freaking out and panicking rather than thinking things through. And if that's the way things go, well, we'll come back to it in the post-game segment.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. It's been a month of downwards consolidation down to some key supports. And on this FOMC, we got ourselves a pretty distinct green reversal candle, getting it close to 1800 again. Do you think this could be a meaningful turn?
Well, let's step back and look at the big picture. This chart was looking awfully darned bearish until the Fed meeting. And what we got was actually a hawkish move from the Fed, but it wasn't as hawkish as the market expected. And that resulted in some relief and a nice green candle. It looks nice and pretty on the chart. It's only one day worth of data, Patrick. And all it's done is it's brought us back up to the very bottom of that resistance zone. When I see daily closes above 1800 on gold, and when I see gold stay above 1800 for several days to a week at a time, that's when I'll get really excited about the gold bull market being back on. Right now, all we've seen is a reaction to an FOMC meeting, a lot of volatility, and it could go any direction from here. Let's wait this out.
All right, well, let's just quickly touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, because while we saw moves in the dollar and the equity markets, really it doesn't look like yields responded at all to the FOMC. I mean, we're trading right now around 143 basis points and really not much going on. Do you think anything has changed in the bond markets?
Patrick, what this situation says to me is that the bond market is still trying to digest the meaning of the Fed's action. Now, if you think about this, they're going to supposedly aggressively taper their balance sheet, and they really mean it this time, and they're not going to bail the market out. That's what they're asking us to believe. We've been told that several times before. Every time that's ever happened, it led to market turmoil. Then the Fed changed their tune and ended up bailing out the market after all. So we all know that's coming. It's a question of when and how long it takes to play out and how far across we look ahead to what's coming next. And so I think that digesting what the Fed is doing and where monetary policy is headed, especially when you consider whether or not Jay Powell is going to stay in his role indefinitely, it's a very, very confusing puzzle. And I think the market is just trying to digest what it means.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Fascinera Capital founder Francesco Filia. Eric, why did we get Francesco on the show this week?
Well, in the past, Francesco has had some very excellent thematic slide decks that have talked about macro themes, and I wasn't expecting this particular topic until we began the interview, and he got into his vision of where the digitization of financial assets is headed, and I wanted to allow him to speak to the topic that he wanted to speak to, so that's what we got.
Eric's interview with Francesco is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Francesco Filia, founder of Fascinera Capital. Francesca prepared a terrific slide deck for today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click on the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Francesco, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been way too long. You know, something I've been thinking a lot about in the last year is DeFi, decentralized finance. It's going to completely and totally change everything. everything. And frankly, I think most people in the industry don't understand that yet. But exactly what form it's going to take, who's going to be in charge, and how we're going to sort out this intersection between new technology and an industry that's slow to change is going to be really interesting to watch. You've got a whole slide deck that talks about first the existing conditions in the economy and leads into where we're headed with DeFi. So I'm really excited about this one. Let's go ahead and dive into it.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here and happy to start with the current situation in markets. And obviously here, it's a little bit of a broken record from myself when it's about expensiveness of both bonds and equities at the same time. And we've been researching this for several years now. We have spotted that the conditions of a bubble financial markets in both bonds and equities for several years now. And definitely we have been wrong in predicting the direction of travel because markets kept rising over this period. But still, you know, like our main point of contention is that valuations make no sense, and it is becoming ultra hard for institutional investors which apply rational investing to be involved with the public bonds and equities at current levels of valuations. And one word on bonds and one word on equities. Bonds since 2016 have been trading at close to zero interest rates, if not deeply negative, and they've stopped functioning effectively. And our idea is that as an asset class, it has been retired and it may be considered defunct. You know, it has stopped to be sensitive to levels of inflations and level of economic activities since several years now. And it's funny that we lament that rates may be rising at this point in time in the markets when we are still talking about negative rates in most Western market economies. Even in the US, we are talking about a 10-year rate at 1.5% and a 30-year rate below 2%. And if you ask me, these levels are very close to zero, and they are closer to zero than anywhere else. And, the problem with this is that, bonds, they have a function within portfolios, which is to counterbalance the allocation to equities, to save the day at times in which the equity have a very bad day. And they can no longer fulfill that function because they're just no longer there. A bond is a coupon-bearing instrument whose coupon currently is zero, and therefore is a zero-coupon bond. But typically, a zero-coupon bond is one that you buy below par and you enjoy the pull to par. In this case, you buy it at par or sometimes above par. So you're looking at a bond within your portfolio and within your wallet, but effectively there is no bond there. What you're looking at is a quasi cash or a quasi bond, but it's definitely a new instrument that you're not accustomed to, and there is nothing there. So within all those balanced portfolios where we have a 40 to 60% allocation to bonds, we can claim that the 40 to 60% allocation really does not exist. Now there is and we may claim that there is no reversion to mean either. Now there is a lot of talk about inflation, right? And inflation has been printing out very widely lately to 6% and over 6%. And obviously there is the fear of rising interest rates. But the problem that we are facing is that if our theory is correct, bonds will not react to that and the rates will not move higher in any meaningful fashion. If it is true that the bond as an instrument has been retired and no longer fulfill the function of what it used to be. And obviously, I'm making a big statement, I'm exaggerating, and I'm doing a reductio by to exaggerate the argument and to make it visible. But basically, my idea is that the so-called Lazarus trade, the trade of mean reversion, where rates go back higher, may not be seen anytime soon. As a reflection of the fact that the linkage between bonds as an asset class and fundamentals is broken in a very fundamental way. And this is a problem. This is a problem because you cannot rely on bonds anymore for asset allocation. And then obviously equities, right? So a word on equities. Equities are also very expensive. It's known to most people. After the pandemic, they went into more extravagant levels. We have seen the technology equity complex reaching $10 trillion in market valuation alone, if you include just the FANGmen stocks. And like we have seen indices this year rallying to new highs. The Nasdaq is 20% up, over 20% up year to date. But actually, when you take out the top five stocks within the Nasdaq, it's actually down 20%. So what you see is not only extreme valuations, but also extreme concentration. And so and there are multiple ratios, and I don't want to go into multiple ratios here during the call, but basically there are multiple data points that they show that the market is as expensive as it has ever been compared to GDP, for example, is twice as expensive as during the dot-com bubble. Obviously, if you are an institutional allocator, it's very hard to cope with a market like this and not be in fear of fast and violent drawdowns. And so, my point is that the job of an allocator looking at traditional asset classes like equity and bonds has become extremely arduous. It's extremely difficult to navigate these markets from now on, and to be able to have faith in markets at these levels. You have bonds that they cannot save the day if equities goes down. You have equities that are ultra expensive and the risk of a drawdown is extreme. And you are left a little bit between a rock and a hard place. Now, after this big rally in levels, we are facing a January 2022, which may be, I'm not trying to predict here a big crash. I think that there is something more interesting to do in the current markets than just predict the next 3 months. But if we look at the next 3 months, there is a possibility that January 2022 looks a little bit like one of the previous Januaries that we've been through. January 2000, January 2008, January 2018, and January 2020. And we know of those Januaries that they preceded fast drawdowns. So the dot-com was followed by the dot-com implosion. The 2008 is obviously linked to the Lehman moment. 2018 saw a fast drawdown, especially on the February VIX complex implosion. And obviously, January 2020 was then followed by a very heavy March following the lockdown as a response to the pandemic. And now again, we may be seeing a blow off top followed by some sort of a drawdown. But the trigger to it is not even that relevant. It could be interest rates following inflation. I don't think so. Or it could be something else like a market following under its own weight. But we already know what is the reaction function of policymakers. And we already know that if there is a fallout in prices, it will be followed by an even more forceful monetary printing and market intervention. And it's probably going to be recouped. And probably another buy the dip is going to show up and the market is going to pick up from those levels. What we have learned over the past over 10 years is that markets have lost their function of allocating to the real economy because they've completely been confined into a space in which they are self-referencing. So whenever there is some fallout, there is an immediate intervention by policymakers, and the market has been unable to develop the anticorps against those fallout to recover on its own merit. And there is one slide in this big deck that is page 11 that tries to draw the linkage between these different market phases and the real DNA of the market as we see it, and goes from depicting. Actually, I think that the big disease in the market is one of short-termism, and it can be seen in the markets, but also in societies at large. And the way I look at it is the full lockdown after the pandemic, but also quantitative easing, also talks of modern monetary theory, and even populism. They are kind of symptoms of the same underlying theme. And the theme is a short-termism. It's basically an attitude to swap, short-term solutions for long-term problems. It's an attitude of not being able to endure duress in markets as much as in society, and therefore to always look for the easy solution that is able to trigger a positive, very short-term effect, but always at the expenses of a longer-term, a bigger problem. This fundamental disease and this fundamental medical condition, let's say, of the markets, but also of society at large, has led into an investment community which has been which has gone through a retailification, I call it. So everybody's playing as a retail, both retail and institutional investors trying to survive to some extent, or fund management. And so in retail, we know the new generation of Robinhood, the new generation of Reddit, like driven investment investments, which is kind of less driven by fundamentals and more by momentum and by emotions to some extent as well. But you know what is more interesting to analyze is the institutional side of things, the institutionalized asset management world, which in an attempt to survive has endorsed some of the attributes and attitudes of the retail community, and therefore has been going from being an hedge fund and hedge investing into a long only. Even when you are a long short equity, you have a very big beta correlation and a very big net exposure. And you know, very few are really shorting stocks these days in any successful fashion, at least. And you know, and the buy the dip mentality has completely spread around and is affecting most market participants. Following this retailification, you have the Bitcoinization of markets. And what I mean by that is basically, you know, a place where public markets have become video gaming, and where effectively, like, there is no reference to the real economy anymore. The reference to the real economy and to fundamentals is lost. And as a consequence of that, the main function of markets has been lost as well, which is allocating resources to the real economy to support both consumers and corporations. And this is reflected also in the current levels of interest rates and in the current level of equities. The good story is that there is an emerging trend which substitutes these let's say, old asset classes, and that at least tries to produce an alternative to them, although not in total, not in full, but for some partial, in some partial ways. And the alternative is you know, ways to access the real economy in a more decentralized fashion. And I'm not talking only about decentralized finance in the ways of cryptocurrencies and blockchain. I'm also talking about platforms and the platform economy, the so-called, and here I utilize another horrible term, which is platformification of credit and the economy. And this represents, in my personal opinion, the new capital markets, that they can offer an alternative to institutional investors, but also to, in general, to market participants. And when I talk about platforms, I mean fintech, the fintech trend, and all these new ways to reach out to the real economy to originate loans and receivables to both consumers and corporations, and that they can form an alternative to bonds at the time in which bonds have disappeared and they are trading at zero.
Okay, so you think that bonds are going to be replaced by new credit instruments that are going to be decentralized finance driven based on some type of secure digital bearer asset?
Substituted is a very big term, right? Because you're talking about the largest asset class out there. But I think that we have seen in the last few years the emergence of these new properties, of this system in transition. And we've gone past the critical threshold of a point of no return. So this tip of the iceberg has been emerging, and the rest of the iceberg will emerge in the course of the following several years. And whether or not it's a full substitution or it's just like getting in parallel to the bond markets, obviously it's more likely to be in parallel to the bond markets. Nothing is going to be really extinguished in full. But definitely we are going to see this trend emerging more and more. We're going to see more and more platforms substituting banks, for example, and the cutting off the middleman being, you know, the bank intermediation more and more in more fundamental ways, and reaching out directly to the real economy to provide the real economy with what now the real economy is not capable of receiving from public bonds, for example. Now, I'm not talking about the large corporates, right? The large corporates always have access to the market, and probably the close to 0% funding cost is justified for them. I'm talking about the middle market, which is also the big one out there. Mid-sized corporates and also like consumers less rich don't have an easy access to funding, and there is a dramatic need on the side of the real economy for funding that the market is no longer able to fulfill, but also banks to some extent. You know, the funding gap just in Europe has been estimated at over 1.5 trillion euros. So we are not talking about a niche in the market. We are talking about the big market out there. We're talking about the real economy.
Francesco, let's talk about how this plays out, because some people would say, okay, the biggest financial institutions have figured out that DeFi is a big thing and you're going to see JP Morgan and other big institutions leading this charge. Other people would say those are big behemoths are just so out of touch, they're lost. What you're going to see is the finance industry being taken over by new companies whose names we've never heard of before. Which is it, or is it something in between? How does this all play out, and how do we get through? You know, I think of this kind of being analogous to the dot-com experience in the late 90s. Everybody suddenly figured out the internet was going to be a big deal, and they were right about that. But they responded by just buying everything with dot-com in its name without thinking first. And it seems like we're kind of at the same stage. What's the next step? How do we get to thinking?
Look, there are very aspects to that, right? So let's look at the one regarding banks, right? The banks, most commercial banks out there have been completely, you know, standing still in the middle of the road, right? And not being able to react. So if you look at the reaction function in the last few years, in which the fintech trend has been emerging and very visibly before everybody's eyes, they have not tried much to counteract it in any meaningful fashion. So actually, the competitive landscape to these new fintechs has been quite an easy one because there was not as much of a pushback from the incumbents. And there are a few exceptions to the rule, of course. There are some banks which have played a very strong game, and I can also name a few like Goldman, JP Morgan, Santander, Standard Chartered. They're very visible on the field and they're very present, etc. But let me talk about everything else, right? Everything else has been really lacking like aggressiveness in tackling this emerging trend. And there are a couple of reasons. One is that, or perhaps three. One is that for how much we want to lament the bank's profitability, but still they make a lot of money. They still can get their money at the sub-zero interest rates from the central banks. And perhaps they don't need to do much to keep being rich, right? You know, the second reason is that it's extremely difficult to do an IT upgrade if you are a bank. You know, you have too much legacy infrastructure, and it's very difficult to detach yourself from it to create something new. The third reason is regulation. There is obviously a random forest of regulation. It's very difficult to disentangle and go follow in the footsteps of unregulated fintechs. If you read the annual letter of Jimmy Dimon, you know, you will see like how real the fintech trend is in how vocal he is about, lamenting, for example, the lack of a level playing field against this fintech, and some of his statements out of the annual letter to investors are banks are playing in an increasingly smaller role in the financial system. The growth in the shadow of fintech banking calls for level playing field regulation. Institutional investors are left without bonds. They need to look at alternatives. The banks are retrenching, and therefore this gap to be filled can be filled by institutional investors.
Okay, Francesco. So we're talking about a scenario where small fintech companies could start displacing big finance companies by offering basically new tricks, new and better ways of doing things. Sounds to me like a setup for a major wave of acquisitions of those fintech companies. But we still have this problem that the way we got to this conversation was institutional investors not really having a good replacement for bonds. So what's the answer to that question?
The answer to that question is that, luckily enough, institutional investors can decide to partially leave the gambling environment in public markets, like especially bonds trading at zero rates, and involve themselves more closely with the real economy through the fintech channels, bypassing perhaps also, banks in their role of, syndicating bonds and stuff, and helping directly the real economy where it matters the most. So in the middle market with the small and medium enterprises. Let's just see what's happening. On the one end, the banks are retrenching from the SME market due to regulation, due to the lack of technology needed to serve the middle market. And they are concentrating on mainstream markets, which means that they're very large corporates around the globe. And this is happening across, not just in Europe, also in the US, even in Asia. As banks withdraw funding, institutional investors can step in their shoes and fulfill also the role of allocating to the real economy. And at the same time, they can also help themselves by substituting some of those bonds yielding nothing with the properly yielding securities generated directly from the real economy through these new technologies, including fintech, but also then eventually at some point down the road, not now, but in a few years, also decentralized finance when the right time comes also to include cryptocurrencies in this argument.
Okay, Francesco, but when you talk about including cryptocurrencies in the argument, if we start with bonds, bonds were a promise by somebody to repay real money to someone somewhere. Cryptocurrency is a token which, similar to gold, its value is basically its uniqueness or its rareness. And there's a lot of debate about that. So does it really make sense for institutions to be replacing bonds, which are a promise for somebody to pay money, with an investment in a token, which maybe has strategic value, depending?
And the quick answer is no, not today, for sure. I believe that the cryptocurrencies market is not ready for institutional adoption, not as yet. I mean, we have seen multiple cases in the last couple of years of what looks like the start of an adoption trend, but definitely it will take longer, and definitely regulation is needed before institutional companies can properly look at allocating into cryptocurrencies. I think what you're seeing now, though, is a definite adoption of a fintech in the meantime, by institutional investors in an attempt to substitute bonds with some alternative yielding securities, which are offered through by fintech. The way I look at it is that you have the old economy, which is the capital markets as we know them, bonds and equities. Then you have the fintech economy, which is effectively financial markets 2.0. And then you have the cryptocurrencies and the decentralized finance and everything else, which is effectively financial markets 4.0. So we are on this timeline. I think the future belongs to a combination of the three. So nothing is being extinguished. It's just being joined by new things and new technologies. And at some point in the future, we're looking at a multiverse where a few things, a few elements are coexisting. There will be bonds and equities. There will be fintech-originated bonds and equities. And there will be also like cryptocurrencies-generated new securities.
Moving on to slide 14, I see that you're starting to talk about a digital future that includes digital lending, which I've for many years said is an absolutely essential part of this. How do you see that playing out?
Well, digital lending is exactly this, right? So it's basically when... So digital lending, the way we classify it here, you see that we compare it with digital assets, right? So digital assets is cryptocurrencies, decentralized finance, NFT, and community-owned economies, like this new trend of decentralization, disintermediation. Digital lending, the way we define it, is the fintech lending. So it's the lending happening outside of the traditional banking channels, and it rhymes with embedded finance and platform economies, right? So it is this way of running a bankless access to the real economy and producing loans and receivables financing for especially SMEs, but also consumers all across the globe. You have seen this trend emerging already 10 years ago in the US, a little bit shorter, around seven years ago in Europe. And this trend is already into the multi-billion. And we expected this to move into the tens of billions in the next 5 years, leading into the market economy of 2025.
Francesco, you've outlined a vision for how you see this unfolding. Tell us a little more about it.
Yeah, so the vision is one in which basically there is this big reshuffle, right, across investors and across also the real economy and the asset classes, right? And I think that the vision is that the asset management community should really be looking at transforming itself away from traditional asset classes and traditional description of investment strategies and try to be designing themselves for the future and to try to build portfolios which are future-proof, right? And nowadays, you have seen that the successful strategies are a little bit of an hybrid, are a little bit more niche, are a little bit more crossover than in the past. So, for example, in the private equity industry and in the venture capital industry, you see funds like Tiger Global like really, you know, hitting the road running by being crossover, right? So instead of being allocated either to public or private assets, they do both, and they include velocity into their modus operandi. And this is something completely new that is taking the whole industry by a storm. In other hedge fund strategies, you see multi-strat, unconstrained, funds that are able to perform better because they can cross-fertilize across multiple managers, and they increase their degrees of freedom when it's about dealing with the market. And so we envision a world in which there is going to be more and more commingling between different things. And definitely, we also see a world in which more assets are investable, right? And, for example, from sneakers to watches to trading cards, you know, everything will become a tradable asset and investable asset. And in this case, obviously, the blockchain comes to help because everything can be linked to a unique identifier, right? And so as a consequence of that, can then be traded. And then we see a market in which, you know, you need to equip yourself, if you are an asset manager, with a lot more technology than you're used to. You know, the old model was that you could, as an hedge fund, manage $5 billion with five people and do a good job at that by calling a macro turning events. I think that that world is a bit lost. And now to make a proper job and to do a sustainable performance over the years, you need to go much deeper, make a much more profound homework. You need to equip yourself with the right technology. And, you need to become a technologist effectively. And there is a lot more work required, for example, in what we have experience of in connecting to the real economy, in being able to channel these funds to the real economy, to both consumers and the corporations. And that takes much longer, right? But it's more sustainable and is more future-proof. It's more looking beyond the next few years. And, at what the market may look like 10 years from now. And I think that, the problem with the asset management industry these days is that it's the same problem that you have when you compare, experience with the experimentation. You know, a lot of the market players these days have got a lot of experience, but because of this experience, they don't experiment. They look at experimentation as something like a waste of time. I think that that is the problem because the market is changing in very fundamental ways. The market is going through a very deep transformation, a critical transformation, and experimentation is really key. If you stop experimenting in times like this, you expose yourself to the changing times, and you're probably going to be outdated very soon, faster than is expected. This is also linked to the age of the investment community, right? You know, it's no surprise that the millennials and Generation Z represent more and more, they have more and more of a role in the current markets. It's absolutely no surprise. They are able to experiment much more than old guys that they think they know and they think they don't need to experiment anymore. It's also the dichotomy between, exploitation and, exploration. Exploitation is when my business is working very well and I don't need to explore. And that is the problem with banks and the incumbents. That is the problem with large asset managers. They're making too much money. They're too rich to really have to explore. But again, if you don't explore in days like this, you run the risk of being outdated and being ruled out by markets and transforming markets in only, a handful of years.
Okay, Francesco. So it sounds like the big picture here is you're expecting a digitization of the financial industry to occur over a period of years where nobody's really in charge. It's just incremental and, new ideas come along and somebody likes it and it takes off. Is that the gist of it? And what does this mean for, we have a lot of institutional investors in the audience. What does this mean if the whole world is going to change over the next 20 years, but it's not really clear how it's going to change? I mean, just knowing that high-level outline of where we're headed would be so helpful, but of course, it's unknowable.
It is unknowable. I mean, I think that institutional investors have got a chance, which is to embrace the novelty in markets, which is offered by new technologies in more and more generous ways. Obviously, it's very difficult for institutional investors that are heavily regulated to embrace the new. But, a point comes in time when that is unavoidable and no longer delayable. And I think that point has come in recent times. And I think that, more and more, these new trends will be visible in performance, right? In performance. When it comes down to asset managers, what matters is really the performance. And if you are linked and limited by the older classifiers in the asset management industry to be either long short equity or relative value fixed income or long only equity or all the other ones. I mean, chances are that you will be unable to compete against the more more flexible players in the market, which are future-proof. And they have equipped themselves with the right technology. They have equipped themselves with the right scope of activities. We are seeing more and more of these in the market. I think we are going to see this trend emerging very robustly. And the institutional investors, I think, ultimately will have to adapt to this changing environment. And they will have also more options, right? And the good part of it that I see is that in this transformation, who benefits is really the middleman and the middle corporate, which are left behind by the traditional markets and have been left behind for such a long time. So actually, this is a very positive trend. It's a trend of decentralization, of disintermediation, dematerialization as well. But it's a trend that ultimately speaks the language of financial inclusion and is very much in tune with times.
Well, Francesco, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Fasanara Capital.
Fasanara is an asset management and technology company and technology platform. We've been around 10 years. We manage strategies in both digital lending and digital assets and quantitative strategies of trading. So digital lending means fintech and fintech technology to reach out to the real economy. Digital assets means cryptocurrencies, arbitrage funds. We have, basically like we are trying to monetize the inefficiency, the volatility of this nascent asset class in cryptocurrencies. And we try basically to build portfolios which are future-proof. And so allow institutional investors, which is the vast majority of our assets under management, to access the real economy utilizing these new technologies in ways in which they can be defended from the twin bubbles in public markets and in ways in which they can find alternatives to the traditional bonds and equities.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Francesco on the show, but I wanted to continue the conversation about the markets, and particularly you wanted to share some of your views on what's going on with the Omicron pandemic, or panic anyway. What's your thinking?
Well, panic is exactly the right word, and I want to first acknowledge both our good friend Jim Bianco at Bianco Research on Twitter, who has an excellent Twitter thread from more than a week ago now, talking about some of these subjects, and also Dr. Chris Martinson, who has a new video on Omicron out in the last couple of days. Both of those are references that I highly recommend to our listeners. Here's how I see this. I think Omicron is going to be a big fat nothing burger in the end. That's the pessimistic end of the range of projection. The optimistic end is that it is the salvation, the thing that ends the pandemic. Because what happens is you have a much more transmissible variant of the virus that everybody is going to get, which is not nearly as dangerous and doesn't result in the hospitalizations and deaths of the previous variants. This potentially is very, very good news for the world. But as Jim Bianco pointed out on Twitter in an excellent thread, what's certain to happen is there's going to be an explosive increase in COVID case counts worldwide, in the United States and every place else. We know that's going to happen. And when it does happen, quite frankly, it won't be news because it's so easy to predict. This is growing at an exponential rate and spreading globally. There's going to be a massive explosion in case counts. Now, I don't think it's going to be a big deal in the end because despite that explosion of case counts, the Omicron death toll still stands at zero. Obviously, people have died with Omicron. I'm not aware of any specific case of anyone dying of Omicron yet, although obviously that's coming at some point. This is, from all the data that we have so far, likely to be not that big of a deal in terms of its true effects. But everything that we've seen from the media and from government has been overreaction. We've already got the Canadian government talking about reclosing its borders to non-essential travel because of Omicron, despite the fact that it has a death toll of zero. So where we had the very same people like Dr. Chris Martinson, who was ridiculed as a fearmonger and an alarmist in January of 2020 when he came on Macro Voices and told us that a global pandemic was coming. He's the guy that was labeled as the alarmist, as the fearmonger. And he's the guy who's now saying, look, if you look at the data, it's probably a blessing in disguise. It might not even be a bad thing. But as Jim Bianco points out, we're going to see this explosion of cases, which will probably panic politicians. And it's already started to panic some politicians. Now, look, if you close down borders and cancel flights, that dramatically reduces the demand for crude oil and for a lot of other things in the economy, and it causes an economic slowdown. So we may very well have a government-induced Omicron slowdown or serious economic event in reaction to Omicron, despite the fact that there is no serious threat being posed by Omicron. Now, this could go the other way, which is people could wake up, the news could get out, somebody on the mainstream media could say, hey, wait, the death toll still stands at zero, folks. This is much more communicable. It's going to spread much wider, but it's not going to kill people and hospitalize people the way the earlier strains did. If that fairly basic knowledge, which has been circulating on the internet for 3 or 4 weeks now, hits the public consciousness, then we're not going to have a problem. But everything we've seen so far, including the decision this week to close the Canadian border, suggests that governments are going to freak out and overreact. And one thing we know for sure is that explosive increase in case counts is coming. So the way I'm looking at this, Patrick, I'm taking risk off the table. I've dramatically reduced length in my crude oil positions, not because I've changed my view. I definitely have a very, very bullish long-term view on crude oil. But I think there's a very real risk that this Omicron scare that happens when the case count explodes is maybe going to give us a new lower low in the market. And so I'm taking some chips off the table, hoping to get back in at a lower price. But after all that, Patrick, let's move on to the chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered. Just go to macrovoices.com, click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, the title page says Santa Claus rally or a lump of coal. What's it going to be?
Well, there's no shortage of people that are still very concerned about these equity markets, but really the first reaction in the post-FOMC period was a technical bounce at a very key level. We did about a 50% retracement toward the moving average, and the buy-on-dip traders bought the dip. And while we are now officially retesting its previous highs, and always the vulnerability technically of a double top, it can always be a risk. But right now, at least up to this moment, throughout this last 2 months, the bulls have really remained structurally in control of the trend of the index. And at this moment, going into this holiday window, I think we have to give the bulls the benefit of the doubt that they may be able to break this out to a higher high. Like you were saying, there are vulnerabilities going into January, which is certainly are things that we will have to be observing. But at least for now, technically, we're at a really important moment where the bulls may be able to give this a shot to make a fresh new high.
Page 3, we've got the Russell 2000 Index Futures chart. What's going on here?
It's interesting that really kind of shows the breadth of the market relative to the S&P 500, which continues to be very heavily weighted toward those FANG stocks that have really driven much of the performance. When you look at the kind of what we can label as the middle America stocks represented by small caps, you can really see that the entire 2021 year has been one really big trade range. There was a fake out of a breakout that happened just a month ago and really has now fallen right back into this trade range. So when you look at page four, I have the percentage of stocks that are trading above their 50-day moving average on that New York Stock Exchange. And again, this was one that we showed last week, but just showing the breadth of the market and really how deep this market correction has been when you're outside of those mega cap stocks that have been holding this market up. And that really, in my mind, is an oversold enough of a condition that could, on the very short term, spur a market rally that could be that Santa Claus rally for the next couple of weeks. Obviously, there are some bigger concerns that you're highlighting, which I in principle agree with. But right now, at least, it's worthwhile seeing whether or not the next few weeks see some new all-time highs.
Patrick, let's move on to page five, U.S. Equity Group Relative Performance.
Yeah, what I really wanted to highlight, a really interesting thing that David Rosenberg was talking about it when we had him on the show, about this idea that bond proxies will potentially perform well. It was really interesting because in the last few weeks, we've really seen a lot of the cyclicals and consumer cyclicals and all these other spaces, a lot of the everything from financials to the energy names, all relatively doing poorly. And a lot of the best performers have been in everything from utilities to REITs to healthcare. And it's a real interesting trend. Now, when the FOMC meeting came out, what we saw was at least a bit of a relief rally in those cyclicals. And I think one of the things I'm going to be watching into next week is whether or not there was some sort of a shift in this current trend and whether those cyclicals actually have more room to go.
Patrick, let's move on to copper futures on page six.
Right. And so copper has been more or less in a sideways purgatory for most of the year after a very strong bull run. And what we've seen, at least for the last 6 months, is that this range between 4 to 450 has really contained the majority of the price action. And you can see that by the high volume nodes that are highlighted with that green highlighted box. And what is interesting is that copper did try to turn up yesterday, but very similar to your view on gold. Well, one day does not make a new trend. There's a lot of repair work that copper has to do, but it is interesting to see that it turned up. And just to that same idea that I was talking about with the group sectors, it'll be really interesting to see whether something more meaningful happened or whether this is going to be a nothing burger on the turn up.
Patrick, let's move on to gold futures on page seven.
Right. And you already highlighted this, and I really felt that it was just worth visually observing it. We can see that gold market has turned up toward that 1800. And just like you were suggesting, I agree with, is that one day does not make a new trend. And there is a lot more repair work to be done. And I know you're talking about that round number of 1800, which is important. But I also think that level that we were looking for, the breakout when we had Ole Hansen on the show around that 1835. It's actually arguably even a little bit more important. I feel like that was almost like a false start breakout. And even if we have short-term rallies in gold that are failing below that level, then there's nothing meaningful going on in gold. And so I probably will take the rest of the year for gold to do some technical repair work before this chart can really set up for something more bullish. Similarly, on page eight, when we look at silver went for a full-on double bottom retest of its lows from September. And while this was a pretty oversold condition and a very significant little reversal candle that came in on the chart, this is still a very distinct downtrend. And while it would be very easy for silver to make it back to the $23 to $24 level just from a relief rally, it is going to take a lot more work for this chart to establish the base from which a meaningful new bull run can go. But one thing that is interesting is when we go on page 9 to the bullish percentage index of gold miners, over the last 5 years, we have seen that when the bullish percentage index gets so oversold that it gets down to the 20% mark or lower, it has often marked key turning points. What is interesting is the gold miners arguably have been victim of tax loss selling as one of the sectors that have been underperforming. It'll be really interesting to see whether these oversold conditions and reversal candles over the next few weeks establish a lot of key bottoms that may see a turn in the space. By no means am I ready to already be hammering on the table like buy, 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 but often this is how bottoms start to form, and I think that the next few weeks are going to be some pretty critical moments to see whether or not these bull trends really start to come off of the lows and a new bull phase begins.
And folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's service, which you can find information about on page 11, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Francesco's slide deck and the charts we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to an oilprice.com article, Was OPEC Right About the Oil Markets? And a Jesse Felder piece on Small Businesses, Big Message for the Markets. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K. And myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.